On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What was 1-6 like for you? What happened to you that day?
When I saw the noose hanging up there, it was really strange for me because I just worked with Lee Daniels on the United States versus Billie Holiday, where she was singing, you know, Strange Fruit, based on the lynchings that she had seen. And then I also thought about, I just read the book, The Devil You Know, and that the lynchings that he talked about, the 5,000 or so lynchings before the Civil War. And I'm thinking and looking at that noose and looking at them, I said, well, they say that that's supposed to be for Pence, that they're going to hang him. But I wonder, first of all, if they're going to hang a white man. And secondly, I wonder how many of us they would hang if we showed up and got in the way. I just thought that, yeah, certainly I would have been killed.
Maxine Waters has been an incredibly important congressperson for a very long time. I could not wait to talk to her about raising the minimum wage, getting COVID relief out to people, and just how she is able to find success as a congressperson. Couldn't wait to do this conversation. Let's get into it. You'll get half of it here. You'll get more of me and Maxine over at patreon.com/Toure Show, and I highly recommend you support us over there. Let's get into it. It's Congresswoman Maxine Waters on Toure Show. One of the things that people have been talking about since the beginning of this is, what are we going to do for renters? How are people who are renters going to survive when a lot of them are not able to work or they're working at far lesser wages? And a lot of homeowners have been helped. We were able to pause our mortgage for 3 to 6 months or more last year. And now you're trying to get something done for renters. What have you been able to do? And how did you do it? Did you have, because I know there's horse trading that goes on. Did you have to give away certain things to get the protection for renters?
Well, thank you very much for asking the question, because rental assistance has been a priority of mine. And I started out when we first had the CARES Act and we were not able to get it in. And then when we had the HEROES Act, I was able to get my idea of what we should be doing into that bill. And as the final bill has come out, we have $21 billion for rental assistance. Now, it has been frustrating because, as you know, there were a lot of rental moratoriums that were being put on, and small landlords were having a fit because they didn't have the money to do repairs and upkeep. Some of them, of course, still have mortgages on that property that they had to pay. And so I agreed with the small landlords that I thought that the extension of the rental moratoriums was being very hurtful and harmful to them, except we didn't have anything in place to replace it. And getting this $21 billion now in place has been, you know, pretty difficult. We have a lot of support from people who know that we need to give rental assistance, but we were not able to really figure out how to get that money into the hands of the renters and how to get that money into the hands of the landlords. And so we know now we've got the money. The bill is going to pass. The $21 billion is in that. It's going to be run, I believe, through the Treasury Department, but they have to now go to the states, and the states' agencies, housing agencies, whatever those agents are with the state, are going to have to get this money out, you know, to the renters and to the landlords. And so the process is stressful for me because I wanted to do this a lot faster. I know that there are people who have not been able to pay their rent since last March, for example. But yes, it's going to be taken care of, but it's not fast enough. And the moratoriums have been mixed because in addition to the federal moratorium that we placed on evictions, the states and the counties all were doing different kinds of things. And they came up with programs for rental moratoriums, and they ended at different times. And so people have been a little bit confused. Some people have been able to get help because some of the cities and counties did take some money from the CARES bill and do some assistance in some way. But it has not been easy. And I know that people are anxious about it. I'm anxious too, but I'm going to follow it all the way through to make sure that the rental assistance is done and that the landlords get paid.
My dream and my thought, because I think it makes good political sense, is that we give people monthly payments, $1,000, $2,000, whatever it is, every month until we feel like we're through this thing directly into the hands of the people rather than into corporations. And I imagine the politician of the party that's able to say, hey, we're giving you money every month, that would be extremely valuable politically. Is that even possible?
No, but it has been talked about. As you know, we had no Republicans on this bill when it passed the House, no Republicans supporting the bill when it came out of the Senate. And so in addition to that, you know, the numbers are so close, you have to worry about whether or not you're going to lose Democrats. And so we have problems, you know, with a couple of our more conservative Democrats. And so that kind of progressive thought, has not been able to move very far.
So that, I mean, the way the structure of the Senate shapes what you guys think about in Congress about, like, we can't send that up because that'll never get through. So we have, right? Is that shapes how you think about legislation every day?
Well, you know, what happens is you pass legislation out of the House, and then you take it to the Senate, and then you fight to try and keep it the way that you passed it. And the senators, even in my estimation, if they don't have any great ideas, they just got to put their fingerprints on it. And so what happens is they start to nitpick here and there. And you saw Manchin, what he did with the unemployment benefits. He reduced it from $400 to $300, took hours and hours and hours on that debate, which didn't make good sense to me. There may be some other nicks in there also. But yes, in order to get a bill that we both agree on, and before we can take it to the president's desk, we have to tolerate, you know, the concerns of the Senate.
I feel like Republicans in the House and in the Senate are not acting in good faith. They are not acting in terms of what's best for their constituents. They're saying, we don't want to do anything that would help this new president, which would then possibly lead to him getting reelected, which could possibly lead to Nancy Pelosi being, you know, continuing to be that. Do you feel like they don't act in good faith? They just do things to try to hurt you, Dems, politically?
Oh, absolutely. You know, they certainly cannot be trusted to act in good faith, as you have described. And I just don't know how they get away with it with their constituents. Now, for this bill, for the Rescue Act, what we did have is so much public support, Republicans alike, you know, their constituents alike who were supporting it, and they still didn't vote for it, and they still get away with it. And I just wonder all the time how they get away with not responding to the needs of their own constituents. Because I want to tell you something, this $1,400 in cash stimulus checks that we're going to give out, you got poor Republicans who need it more than poor Democrats, you know, and on and on and on. You know, that money is so important, whether you're talking about, you know, small businesses, you're talking about restaurants that are closing down, whether you're talking about many of the businesses that won't ever open up again. These guys literally choose to oppose us because it is political, as you have identified. It is about whether or not they're going to look successful. It is whether or not they're going to get reelected. It's whether or not this president is going to get reelected. But they absolutely have made a mistake on this one because, like I said, the public does support it. Number one, the president looks good on being able to have delivered $1.9 trillion in a relatively short period of time. And we're going right to the needs of the people, and they're waiting. They're desperate. We've had these food lines where people, women and the children, standing in line around blocks to get, you know, a bag of food because children and families are hungry and the lines have been long. And so, yes, we're going to have the appreciation, certainly, of Democrats, but we're going to have the appreciation of a lot of Republicans who are desperate, who are in need, who are poor, who are living on the edge, who have lost their jobs, on and on and on with that. So they made a mistake on this one. They're going to get hurt, not us.
I mean, I feel like when we talk about how can they survive making these sorts of moves, it's partly because they don't live in the reality that we live in, which includes facts and logic and history. They get news, quote unquote, from Fox, which paints the story in an entirely dishonest way, and they are misinformed. And I mean, that's part of why they get to succeed.
You know, that is so true, and I'm baffled about how misinformed they are. When they invaded the Capitol, and there was one woman who was caught in kind of a crush, and they put a microphone before her to ask her, you know, why was she here? What was she doing? And she said, this is the revolution. We've got to take back our government. This is a revolution. And she was serious about it. And, you know, this indoctrination that they're able to do is baffling. But you would be surprised how many people bite and how many people buy into these lies and these distortions.
What was 1-6 like for you? What happened to you that day?
Well, to tell you the truth, I had gone over to the gallery to witness the proceedings where the electoral votes were going to be announced and dealt with. And so once we had to divide, as you know, when they objected, and the way the Constitution goes, you get an objection, and then you divide. The Senate goes back to the Senate. The House stays over here, and you debate it, okay? So once the division took place, and I sat there and began to watch our debate, well, I knew everything that our people were going to say. So I said, you know what? I think I'll go back to my office. I don't need to sit here and watch this. So I got up and walked back to my office from the inside, didn't see anything, anybody. By the time I got to my office and turned on the television, they had breached, you know, the barricades. They were, you know, breaking, you know, the glass. They were out in a way that the chief of police told me never could happen. 4 days before the invasion, I had a 1-hour telephone meeting with the chief of police. I asked him about whether or not they were going to be able to get up on the plaza. He said, no, they would have barricades. I asked him whether or not they knew that the Proud Boys were in town and the Oath Keepers, and how were they going to deal with that? And they said that they did not do reservations for space for people to protest based on groups, that if an individual came in, it could be an individual from the Proud Boys, it could be an individual, you know, from the Oath Keepers, but they wouldn't know that. But they're going to keep a close eye. And I said, well, on the grassy part, where maybe there's going to be a confrontation with protesters who will come and say that they're opposite from them and what they're trying to do. He said, oh, we'll have police in there everywhere, and we won't allow that. I said, well, what are you going to do about guns? They do not allow guns. This is not a gun carry state. They don't allow guns in D.C. He said, well, if any guns show up, we're going to deal with that right on the spot. I even went so far as to tell him, look, you should be concerned about the top of the buildings, because Martin Luther King and Kennedy were, you know, targeted from up high. I said, and so you should have the top of the, he said, they can't get on top of our buildings. He said, in order for them to get on top of the Capitol, they'd have to go into the Capitol. And then what did we see? Them scaling the wall. I asked him if they could block off the intersection up at the Capitol. He said, no, they couldn't do that because they had their First Amendment rights. And, you know, they had to have passageways, you know, down the main thoroughfare, on and on. And he made every excuse. But the Proud Boys had been in town days before the invasion took place. As a matter of fact, I think the Metropolitan Police had driven the head of the Proud Boys out of town because they had caused some trouble with one of the churches, I believe, here. But they didn't seem to know any of this. Or if they knew it, they were lying to me and telling me that we didn't have to worry. And so anyhow, the police were either, you know, like I said, ignorant and incompetent, or they just plain didn't want to see us be able to drive them away or drive them back. But what I discovered was they didn't even know the numbers that were in town. And even though there had been a march, they were surprised when they took over, you know, both sides of the Capitol. They were on both sides of the Capitol. But they didn't.
Were you scared at any point?
You know, I was worried. Here's what I thought. I thought, boy, if you show your face out there, they'll kill you. You know what I'm saying?
You thought that about yourself? If I go out there, I'll be killed?
I knew they would kill me. I just know that. Because, you know, just days before that, I was getting threats of more threats. We get threats a lot. And I've been able to get some indicted and some convicted. But I know that they're haters. And they had weapons. And I just know if I had walked up there any place where they were, I would have been killed. I believe that. I absolutely believe that. And so I got into my office and I got a call at some point. Well, I called the chief of police and I just told him everything I thought about him and how he had misled me, or how he was incompetent and how this was totally unacceptable. And I just slammed the phone up in his face. But then I got a call that said that the Capitol Police was guiding all of the members into a room, a big room, because they wanted to keep tabs on us and know where we were. And I told him, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not moving out of this office. We locked all of our doors. We barricaded ourselves in, and I did not move. My staff did not move. And come to, you know, we're so glad we didn't, because they took them all to a big room in the Cannon building where we had Republicans with no mask, and we had Democrats, even though the Republicans didn't tell us, but our Democrats who got sick, who got COVID, you know. And so I'm so glad I didn't go there. But evidently, they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't have a plan. So this business of rounding us up and taking us someplace was one of these last minute things that they thought they should do in order to provide us with some kind of safety. But they didn't have a plan about what would happen, you know, if in fact they got literally taken over by a mob. And so it was unnerving watching them. And I was thinking about the hatred that I saw, but I was thinking about the way that they was breaking the glass in the window. And one guy, you know, just took it with his fist, and then one wrapped a little something. And I mean, they were angry. They were mad. They were crazy. And I just thought that, yeah, certainly I would have been killed. And when I saw the noose hanging up there, it was really strange for me because I just worked with Lee Daniels on the United States versus Billie Holiday, where she was singing, you know, Strange Fruit based on the lynchings that she had seen. And then I also thought about, let's see, I just read the book, The Devil You Know, and that the lynchings that he talked about, the 5,000 or so lynchings before the Civil War. And I'm thinking and looking at that noose and looking at them, I said, well, they say that that's supposed to be for Pence, that they're going to hang him. But I wonder, first of all, if they're going to hang a white man. And secondly, I wonder how many of us they would hang if we showed up and got in the way. And so it was you know, just absolutely almost giving up on our government and giving up on our ability to deal with these domestic terrorists. You know, the idea that they could come in broad open daylight in the way that they did and, you know, basically break into the Capitol and go into, you know, the Senate floor and into Nancy Pelosi's office and all of that. I just really had a feeling of, these people are out of control. They've got the president on their side. They've got the weapons, and we can't do anything with these people. They're going to cause real harm, and they're going to kill folks. That's what I really thought.
Michelle Obama is one of the most inspiring, intelligent, graceful, unapologetically Black people that I could think of. Just her existing makes me happy, makes me feel inspired, makes me want to be a little bit more like her every day, because she seems to be just this extraordinary person. So if there's any sort of podcast about her, I want to listen to that. Life Kit from NPR has a whole episode on Michelle Obama. It's part of their whole Black Stories, Black Truths collection, where you'll hear stories of Black joy, Black resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account of what it means to be Black today from a unique Black perspective. There's a Code Switch episode about Dr. King, and I love Code Switch. There's It's Been a Minute about Eric Andre, who I love. We are not the same person, even though a lot of people think we look alike, even though he lives in my neighborhood now. But stop telling him he looks like me. Stop telling me I look like him. There's a Pop Culture Happy Hour about the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I loved that show. That show meant so much to me. This is what Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR is all about. Stories about Black America and Black culture. Whole Pop Culture Happy Hour on Abbott Elementary, which is another amazing modern Black show. From Megan Thee Stallion to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air to the women behind the Montgomery bus boycott to the Color Purple, the stories of Black Stories, Black Truths will take you inside the Black community and Black culture. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. Life doesn't happen in bi-weekly segments, so why should your paycheck? The money you earn every day can be in your hands today with Earn In. Earn In is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 a day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earn In app, verify your paycheck, and then you can access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips automatically repaid from your next paycheck. So if you need to make a repair suddenly, to get a new dress or a new shirt or shoes, you can do that. You can get the money that you've already earned but haven't been paid. You can get that now with Earn In. Make Earn In a part of your financial routine and join their 3.5 million customers who say things like, when I think about Earn In, I think about financial stability and security. It gives me peace of mind. It gives you the ability to access your money now. So download Earn In today. That's E-A-R-N-I-N in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earn In app, type Torre Show under podcast when you sign up, and it'll really help us. Torre Show under podcast. Earn In is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details.
Some of your current colleagues helped the insurrectionists. Do you feel safe being in a body day to day with people who thought, those are my people, not you and Nancy?
Well, you know, is I don't think about really feeling safe. I know that they had to stop them from bringing guns on the floor. And I know that when you talk to some of them, and particularly the one that we know belongs to QAnon, et cetera, I just get angry. And I just, you know what I really think? You come for me, I'm coming for you. You know what I really think? If I have to die, I just have to die because I'm not going to walk around here in fear of you. You just don't come for me, okay? I mean, that's really what I was thinking.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Police officer shot and killed a black woman in her own home.
Incident after incident, year after year.
Say their name. A podcast that focuses on the assault and killing of unarmed black people by police and in Stand Your Ground states.
I'm the mother,
father,
sister,
uncle,
grandmother.
We were best friends.
We are humanizing these headlines, figuring out who these victims really were before the hashtags. Say their name. You can listen on the Acast app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What should happen to the people who invaded the Capitol that day?
Well, first of all, the FBI supposedly is identifying them one by one, two by two. They're arresting some. Some are being held. Others are being released on their own recognizance. They're all supposed to be facing indictments, et cetera. And so I think they should keep up with that because here's what I believe. I believe that some of those people really did not think that anything right. can happen to them, that they right. had the president on their side. And so they're looking to be taken care of. And some of them didn't even think they'd be arrested. Some of them think, well, if I get arrested, you know, they are going to bail me out. But, you know, we control the courts and the judges and the president does. And so we don't really have to worry. That's what I think. Now, what do I think about domestic terrorists? I think that unless this country gets a handle on, identify, and come up with special ways of convicting domestic terrorists, that we're in for a long haul with them getting bolder and bolder, particularly if Trump, you know, raises all of this money, intimidates those Republicans who are afraid to vote against him or say a word against him, that I think they get stronger. And also, you know, there are so many tricks in all of this because the head of QAnon had a relationship with the FBI. And they basically was the head of the QAnon was basically an informant who was given information on stuff like drug dealing and those kinds of things. And you have to be doing that in exchange for not bothering you because they knew he was. You know what I'm saying? So when I look around, I don't know who to trust. You know what I mean? I don't know who to trust. You know what I'm saying? And I tell my grandchildren and everybody every day, I say, we live in a society where many of the services that we need are provided by whites, but we don't know who they are. We don't know what they're thinking. What do you know if you're in an emergency and you go to the emergency room and there's a white doctor? What do you know about the teacher that's teaching your child? What do you know about, you know, you don't
well, we
know.
We do know that white supremacist groups have for years been telling their members, join the local police department so we can continue to maintain power that way. So when you or I are, and you doesn't happen to you because you have a bubble, but when I get pulled over by a cop or when I get eyeballed walking down the street in Brooklyn by a cop, I don't know that he's not a Proud Boy or an Oath Keeper or some sort of white supremacist.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it's not only the local police, it's your military, it is the police. And you know, what's surprising is you have veterans who have been a part of, and that's not all of them, but I do know that that's what's being identified. And even they have identified some Capitol Police here who are aligned with and identified with some of the white supremacist groups. So you don't know what you're confronting. You don't know to whom you're talking. You don't know who may do harm to you. You just don't know.
What, let me go back to policy, because you're the chair of the Financial Services Committee, yes. Incredibly important committee. Yes. I want to talk about what that work entails generally, but specifically, what's the chance that we can get $15 minimum wage for folks? That would make such a difference for millions of Americans.
Well, that issue is not in financial services. That's in ways and means. However, it doesn't matter. Whatever it was in. No, we don't have the votes for it. No, we don't have the votes for it.
We don't have the votes in the Senate because you have them in the House.
We have it in the House, in the Democrats, with the Democrats. But you don't have the votes with Democrats in the Senate. You're absolutely right.
And why wouldn't you bring it up and make Republicans show their hand, make them vote on it and see, like, we're all voting against $15 for you guys?
Well, of course, we made them vote against it on the House side. But over on the Senate side, it's a whole different operation about how they do things and what gets brought up and when it gets brought up and all of that. And so we've just got to keep pushing, and we've just got to keep trying to leverage and embarrass and use whatever tools we have. Because even now, $15, that's outdated. I mean, you know, you really need more than $15 now. We started on $15 several years ago. And so we just have to keep working. But I tell you what will make the difference. In the final analysis, the people on the street will make the difference. And to the degree that, you know, people are willing to organize and make sacrifices and, you know, basically show up in the numbers that we can show up, we can create some change. We already saw some weakening of racist attitudes about George Floyd after he was killed by the local cop. And you saw people coming along, some of the corporations, the kind of things that they advocated for, kind of embarrassing, you know, trying to make it look like that they truly understood, what have you. But we saw some attempts by others to say, oh my goodness, I didn't realize it was that bad, that was that terrible. And they hit the streets. You saw a kind of a mixture of young and old, all different ethnicities and people. So you saw a little movement and people saying, you know, this is outrageous, but, you know, it's not enough.
It seems to be, so when you're running an important committee or, you know, just being an important congressperson, it seems to me like we, the public, see you giving a speech, doing an interview, but the real work is to be able to go to another member privately and say, how can I get you to vote for this with me? Can I give you something? Is that, you know, being persuasive and just, can I give you something that'll help you out? Is that where the real work is? And how do you do that?
No. It doesn't really work that way. I mean, you can make all the personal appeals you want. No, that does not work that way. As a matter of fact, there are some things you may be able to get some bipartisan support on, not a lot. But when there's resistance, it is for a lot of reasons. And it's not just the issue itself. I want to tell you the basis of all of this is racism. The basis of this. In our society, it is that maybe you don't hear, you don't see, but, you know, it comes out in different ways. As a matter of fact, when you watch the previous president in the way that he, you know, sent these dog whistles to his constituency. Remember how he talked about our cities and talked about, you know, okay, he was sending a message that, you know, these Black people don't care. They don't care about these communities. Look how they live. That's terrible. They're never going to do any better. We can't waste the taxpayers' money on them. When he talked about our countries, you know, and other countries, Black countries, you know, he's sending dog whistling to them. When he talked about the athletes, A big message. Look at all these big black athletes doing so well. They're rich. They live good. You know, you don't even have this. You know what I'm saying? They're doing better than you're doing. All of this, the basis of all of this stuff is racism.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
The basis of what separates Dems and Republicans is racism.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And this idea that Trump absolutely strengthened his voice on had to do with taking it back. Mm-hmm. Taking it back. Take back our country. You know what I mean? This is ours. They don't have any right to be, you know, yeah.
We know that the Republican Party is completely for white people. Is the Democratic Party completely for black people, or are we sort of mixed that, like, because we need to pull in white voters as well to survive?
But here's the answer to that. You have some of our Democrats, and, you know, a majority of them, who have some basic philosophies about life and some basic philosophies about fairness. And they belong to the Democratic Party. We have some more conservatives who it is convenient for them to belong to the Democratic Party. They don't always believe what the Democrats are working on, but they vote with you because it is in their best interest to do so for one or two or three reasons. And so when you talk about Democrats versus Republicans, you absolutely have more Democrats that believe in fairness and equality, and that no matter what, they should be at least about the business of seeing that children get educated, that there's a decent healthcare system, that, you know, there should be housing. That on the opposite side of the aisle, they think it's not their fault and that the government spends too much money now and that those people need to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. No, we shouldn't have public housing paying all this money out for poor people. No, so there is a difference. There is a significant difference.
So how do you go into the the body, go into work and get things done when you know there's this fault line and it's rare that it's ever crossed.
Well, you know, we just had 4 years of not getting anything done. Right. You know, I tried to get this president impeached from the beginning, right after the swearing in, because having watched him during the primary and the way he talked about and treated human beings, you know, grabbing women by their private parts, mocking and mimicking disabled people, I just couldn't see why folks didn't understand who this character was and what he was all about.
But they did, and they liked it.
Well, some did. And
right.
He had a hardcore group that will follow him no matter what he says or what he does. These are your hardcore racists. You know what I'm saying? Yes. But we beat them. We beat them because we have more people and blacks understanding the power of the vote. And what Stacey Abrams was able to do, based on her experience, based on the fact that she'd run for office and knew that it had been stolen from her. And she went and she didn't stop. And she kept working it until we got the numbers and we were able to put, two Democrats into the Senate, which is just unheard of.
Have black people or are black people being sufficiently rewarded for the support to Joe Biden and the Dems that they gave, which led to a Democratic controlled Senate or a 50-50 Senate and a Joe Biden presidency? Because it's really black folks in Atlanta and Philadelphia and Detroit and Milwaukee who really showed up, you know, and made the difference. Are we getting our just due from having given Joe Biden the presidency?
Well, here's what, and of course, we're still early in it, and of course, time will tell. However, when you take a look at some of the appointments that are being made, some of them are very good. Some, I think, of them, maybe we would have preferred to have a black in, but I think the last count was there were about 12 appointments that we liked an awful lot. And so he said he's got our back. He said we had his back. And he's got our back. And so we are looking not only for appointments, but public policy. And so in the $1.9 trillion response that, you know, he's led, that's going to get voted out of the House in agreement with what has happened in the Senate and sent to his desk. We like the fact that he didn't back down on the amount because we even had Democrats sometimes who thought that, it's too much money, never going to be able to get it. Republicans thought, you know, it was too much money, even though they had given tax breaks to the richest people in this country. $1.9 trillion was money. So he stuck with that. And we think that he did good. He's doing good by, increasing the testing for COVID-19, making sure that it got into Black communities even deeper and more. In this bill, we have substantial money for the vaccines and making sure that they get into all these minority communities, even though, you know, a lot of Black people are suspicious about the shots. And so far, he's doing okay. He's got a lot more to do, but he's doing okay.
What can we do to get more Black people to be comfortable taking the vaccine? Because as you just said, more of us are vulnerable and dying from COVID for yes. social reasons. You know, yes. we're more likely to be essential workers. We're more likely to have pre-existing health conditions. We're more likely to be in multifamily homes. And yet a large percentage of us, a good 30 to 35% of us are like, I'm not taking the vaccine at all. I remember Tuskegee. I remember medical racism. And I'm like, you guys, like what? So what can we do to get more Black people? Because you've had your shots, right?
Sure, had two. Yeah, Pfizer. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so here's what we have to do. First of all, we have to demonstrate that we are taking our shots and we're asking everybody else to take theirs. We've got to go out, to the ministers and the churches and the social clubs and organizations. And it's hard, living the way that we're living. But we've got to do everything that we can. I want to, in Los Angeles, I was talking with one of the health centers that's begging, You know, they've got all of this medicine in this center, and Black people are not showing up. As a matter of fact, because Black people are not showing up, whites are coming from other neighborhoods, and they're going into our neighborhoods getting the shots because it's available. It's available. Now, I really do believe that one of the things that will help out, two of the things that will help out, I think the ministers could be a lot more influential. You know, they have the most number of Black people in, you know, in the religious efforts in the church on Sunday when the churches are open. But now if they're doing it virtually, however they're doing it, they're in touch. They've got a database, all of these churches. And I think that when the minister says, I'm getting mine, and I want everybody at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, whatever, to be at so-and-so to get your, I think it could help a lot. The other thing that I think could help is athletes and entertainers. Our hip hop movement still has a lot of power. And I think, you know, you get a Cardi B and, you know, you get P. Diddy and Jay-Z. And you get everybody out there, and oh God, don't bring Beyonce out there. I mean, come on.
For more from me and Congresswoman Maxine Waters, join us over at patreon.com/Toure Show. Thank you so much to the Congresswoman for a great interview. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle, Brenda Cox, Kathy F., Keena Murphy, Earl Dorsey, and Theo Tokas. Toure Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Toure and on Instagram at Toure Show. Toure Show is written by me, Toure, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhull. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.